A magnitude 9.0 earthquake strikes off Japan's coast. Automatic shutdowns work perfectly. Backup generators kick in. For 41 minutes, everything goes according to plan. Then, a 45-foot wall of water crashes over the 19-foot seawall at Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Station, and the world's second-worst nuclear disaster begins. What followed wasn't just a Japanese tragedy. It exposed a global delusion about nuclear safety that persists today. Here's the uncomfortable truth. The same vulnerabilities that destroyed Fukushima exist at nuclear plants worldwide, protected only by the comforting lie that it can't happen here. The tsunami didn't just flood Fukushima. It obliterated the entire concept of defense-in-depth safety. Water knocked out 12 of 13 emergency diesel generators, destroyed electrical distribution systems, and plunged operators into darkness. They worked by flashlight, unable to monitor reactor conditions or operate critical systems. Battery power would last mere hours. Meanwhile, Japan's fragmented nuclear bureaucracy, multiple agencies with overlapping responsibilities, created instant chaos. The designated emergency command post had no power, phones, food, water, or radiation filters. In Tokyo, Prime Minister Kan's basement situation room couldn't communicate with nuclear experts five floors above. Workers scrambled to connect mobile generators only to discover incompatible plugs and cables too short to reach. This wasn't bad luck. It was systemic failure. Emergency plans had never contemplated a station blackout of this magnitude because regulators deemed it too improbable to require preparation. That assumption would prove catastrophic. On March 12th, a massive hydrogen explosion tore through Unit 1's reactor building. Plant Superintendent Masao Yoshida, ordered to halt seawater injection due to government confusion, secretly continued the operation, a decision that likely prevented worse outcomes. 2 days later, Unit 3 exploded with such force it destroyed walls and roof, creating radiation levels exceeding 30 rem per hour. Unit 2 suffered a containment breach, threatening massive environmental releases. Then came the most puzzling development. Unit 4, shut down for maintenance with its core stored in a spent fuel pool five stories up, exploded mysteriously. These pools, perched high with minimal protection, represented decades of regulatory complacency. If water levels dropped enough to uncover fuel rods, they could catch fire and release more radioactive cesium than a reactor meltdown. Ironically, Fukushima's dry storage casks survived the disaster without intervention, offering a crucial lesson authorities largely ignored. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Adano repeatedly assured citizens that radiation posed no immediate risk to health, urging them to remain calm. These reassurances rang hollow as evacuees moved repeatedly and explosions dominated news coverage. TEPCO's communication failures epitomized the breakdown. Junior executives apologized for causing inconvenience while omitting that reactor meltdowns had occurred on March 12, information not publicly acknowledged until June. Officials deliberately withheld critical data, including speedy radiation plume predictions that could have prevented unnecessary exposure for thousands. The beautiful village of Itate, declared one of Japan's most scenic just a year earlier, became unnecessarily contaminated because officials sat on data showing the radiation plume's path. When radioactive iodine appeared in milk and spinach up to 90 miles away, the government hesitated to impose bans. Public anger exploded when officials authorized schools to reopen with radiation limits 20 times higher than normal standards for children. Japan's press club system, where mainstream journalists work from newsrooms inside government offices, discouraged aggressive investigation. The result was what one researcher called a sense of betrayal that fundamentally damaged institutional trust. As Fukushima spiraled out of control, NRC Chairman Gregory Jasko testified before Congress that there is no water in the spent fuel pool at Unit 4, with extremely high radiation levels. Based on thermal imaging and remote data, the U.S. recommended Americans evacuate within 50 miles, four times Japan's 12.4-mile zone. Japanese officials disputed this, producing video footage showing water in the pool and inviting NRC representatives to verify. The diplomatic clash highlighted fundamental differences in crisis communication and safety standards. Despite pressure, the U.S. maintained its 50-mile recommendation, creating tension and raising uncomfortable questions. If American experts believed 50 miles was necessary, what did that say about similar U.S. reactors? The NRC carefully controlled messaging, avoiding speculation about domestic risks while reviewing emergency procedures. This disparity complicated worldwide responses as nations struggled to determine appropriate protective measures. The incident exposed how international nuclear safety standards remain dangerously inconsistent. 1 year after Fukushima, four of five NRC commissioners confidently declared it couldn't happen in America. Our infrastructure, our regulatory approach, our practices at plants would prevent Fukushima from occurring, one asserted. This confidence mirrored Japan's nuclear establishment delusion. The uncomfortable reality? The NRC remains trapped in tortuous logic, reluctant to require higher safety standards for fear of suggesting existing plants aren't safe enough. After Three Mile Island, the NRC proposed filtered vents, hydrogen controls, and external backup systems. The industry's counter-campaign succeeded completely. In 1985, the NRC abandoned efforts to require severe accident protection, declaring existing plants pose no undue risk. The 1988 backfit rule, born from Reagan-era anti-regulatory fervor, required cost-benefit analysis, converting human lives into dollar figures comparable to industry costs. Japan followed suit, developing voluntary accident management measures, treating severe accidents as too improbable for mandatory countermeasures. Even after Fukushima, the NRC rejected containment vent filters, despite low costs. Nuclear advocates now promote new reactor designs with passive safety systems, yet vendors still seek Price-Anderson Act liability protection, suggesting limited confidence in their own safety claims. The numbers are staggering. $317 billion in costs, TEPCO's $15 billion loss, 1,500 square miles contaminated, and nearly 16,000 tsunami deaths, with radiation chaos hindering rescues and raising haunting questions about who might have been saved. When Prime Minister Noda declared the plant under control in December 2011, experts called it premature and political. "The plant is like a black box, and we don't know what is really happening," one official admitted. Public sentiment shifted dramatically. Three-quarters of Japanese now supported eliminating nuclear energy. Fukushima revealed that nuclear safety isn't merely technical but cultural, requiring constant vigilance and questioning, qualities both Japanese and American establishments had lost to complacency. The lesson isn't about earthquake zones or tsunami walls. It's about the dangerous belief that it can't happen here until it does. Nuclear technology's complexity has allowed the industry to hide behind jargon while excluding a public from decisions, even though the public bears the greatest risk. Current safety standards emerge not from rigorous analysis, but from industry lobbying and regulatory capture. As Chuck Casto stated emotionally, "We don't want any more heroes. We need systems designed so thoroughly that heroism becomes unnecessary. The question isn't whether we can make nuclear power perfectly safe, it's whether we'll demand the protection we deserve rather than accept what industry finds convenient."